Hello and welcome to episode 124 of the Nerds Assemble podcast.
This week we'll be looking at Spider-Man, Bethesda and Goddess, and our feature will be discussing whether comic book movies need to do more. Nerds.
Hi, I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Cookie.
Unfortunately, we've got no retro this week, but as ever, you can find notes for this episode over at www.nerdsassemble.co.uk. You could also comment there. You find links to social accounts. You could just get in touch with us right now or ask questions and comment via email at contact@nerdsassemble.co.uk, or you could try tweeting us at nerdspodcast. Plus, please, if you are a listener, obviously, because you're listening and you're hearing me say this, of our podcast, please do take a moment to fill out our short listener survey, which is at bit.ly/nerds2015. It would be really helpful if you fill it out, because it will help us plan out the podcast for the rest of the year.
Do you know how many responses we've got
now?
I can't remember off the top of my head, no.
No, okay.
But first bit of news, it sort of came in either just after we started podcasting or something last week.
It usually happens that way.
Yeah. So Spider-Man's coming home to Marvel, sort of, basically.
Yay! About fucking time.
It's not like it's completely back.
No, but it's a good preparation.
Yeah.
It?
Yeah. So, according to Deadline, I'm quoting Deadline, by Sony Pictures Entertainment and Marvel Studios are joining forces on the next iteration of Spider-Man. Kevin Feige, who has steered a ton of hit franchise launches for Marvel, boards the project as producer. He will produce the next films with Amy Pascal, who just left the executive suites at Sony for a big production deal. So, Amy Pascal, who failed to properly react to the Sony hacking scandal before Christmas, who finally left Sony in the last couple of weeks, has now still obviously got a job in with the same crowd anyway.
To be fair, though, she was actually one of the original people behind the original Spider-Man and Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, but if I was her, I'd keep my head down for a little bit rather than I'd take a year out, perhaps. So, Cookie, who would you like back?
Oh, Tobey Maguire would be ace. Bring back Tobey. Tweet us. Hashtag bring back Toby. Yeah.
Lots of people want Toby back. David Heard sort of talked about it on a blog post on the Hex Dimension last
think it'd
week.
Be good. Yeah, he did. And it made good sense. I agree with him. I don't normally agree with him. That's scary.
Just to further explain the deal, according to Deadline, under the deal, Spider-Man will appear in his film. Under the deal, Spider-Man will appear in his Marvel film that is part of Marvel's cinematic universe, and then Sony Pictures will thereafter release the next installment of its $4 billion Spider-Man franchise on July 28, 2017. There have been rumours, that Sony might sell the web slinger back to Marvel and Disney, but that's not what is happening. Instead, Sony keeps its top franchise, but this opens the door to Marvel's comics' biggest superhero being able to cross-pollinate in the Marvel universe.
This sounds...
It also helps them, to be fair, because they can bring... If they've done the deal properly, they could bring characters into their Spider-Man universe.
Mm.
We could be Ace. We might actually get Spider-Man versus the Kingpin. Yay! Spider-Man teaming up with Daredevil. Yay!
Okay, so despite all of those plans, previous plans for other Spider-Man-related films are a little bit up in the air, like another Sinister Six movie.
Mm.
Apparently that's just been put on hold, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Scrap the bloody thing.
Yeah. I don't understand why they thought it would ever quite work as a concept.
No. Well, I mean, obviously this deal is kind of a winner for everybody in a way, because the fans don't really care that part of the money is going towards Sony. You know, they just want Spider-Man in, the Marvel Universe. And it sounds like Marvel may have at least a certain amount of control, even if Sony have executive say on the following Spider-Man franchises.
Yeah, which I think is fair enough. I mean, they did well with the first two Spider-Mans. Spider-Man 1 and Spider-Man 2, Tobey Maguire, were brilliant. Spider-Man 3, they got a bit too cocky and put too many villains in and just rushed the whole story, in my opinion. The Amazing Spider-Man of Andrew Garfield. I do like Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man.
Mm.
I did like his sort of cockiness, but it was all right. The second one, what a waste of Jamie Foxx.
The review we did for Hex of the second film is one of our most viewed reviews of last year. Mm. I think it's because of how much we slated it more than anything else.
It had good premise. It was just the fact they didn't utilise the characters properly, in my opinion.
I also found the characterization of Jamie Foxx's character to be somewhat alarming because there were clearly...
That's what I mean. They didn't do it properly.
Yeah, there was clearly issues with him on a deeper psychological level, which they then didn't bother to explore as they probably should have done. And it was just like he's a deranged individual who's somehow ended up with superpowers.
And then this whole Sinister Six movie, I just didn't really... I didn't see that work. And I would have preferred... If they wanted to expand the universe, they could have done a Black Cat movie.
Mm.
That would have been cool.
Yeah.
That would have been really cool. But no, we'll have the Sinister Six instead. Okay, whatever. Which I didn't see working. But so I liked Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man, but
I just compare
with my fellow guy on Hex, where we need an older, more mature Spider-Man.
I just hope they didn't do her origin story with him.
Well, that's the thing, because I think... because they're pretty much going to reboot it again, aren't they?
But they can do the more mature, older Spider-Man. You don't have to go back there. I mean, I know it's not a fact, but I can see his cameo being in Civil War, because Civil War was a story that Spider-Man was quite a big part of. And I've been wondering since it was announced how they were going to do it justice without Spider-Man in it, because he had such a pivotal role in it.
Mm.
But if you stick a young... Because they're going to have to... I'm assuming there's going to be some sort of continuation between his cameo in there and his standalone movie and that sort of thing to make it all work and make them be able to come back in and out of the Marvel Universe over the years. So if they have a young Spider-Man, it just ain't going to work.
Well, I mean, anybody that's kind of read, Civil War will know that, you know, it's a massive event in, the Marvel Universe, and it kind of makes me wonder what kind of direction they're going by having it as, Captain America's third film. So they're obviously probably going to be, making it more of a personal thing between, Captain America and Tony Stark, as per, the memes that have come out where it's like, the scenes from Avengers where Stark and Captain America, Steve Rogers, are disagreeing, and then it's like, Marvel thingy.
Yeah, like when he's saying to him in Avengers, you can never be a hero. You don't know what it takes to be a hero. That's it. It'll be quite cool.
Remember one being Steve Rogers saying, "I preferred Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock." Civil War.
All right,
it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to move on to a next story now, and there isn't much to say. We just want to. I think at this point, it's what could happen is going to be pure damn speculation, because Bethesda have announced that they're running their first ever showcase at E3 this year.
But, yay!
Because, am I thinking right that it's going to be like, one of the actual conferences? Like, say, for example, EA, Nintendo.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, not necessarily Nintendo nowadays.
And Ubisoft
nowadays,
would be a better
Ubisoft
comparison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But have they got enough games to
do that?
They've
obviously got something huge to announce.
Elder Scrolls Online version 4.
A lot of people, since this came out last week, have been like, oh god, please let it be another Fallout. I would say, considering the order the previous generation of consoles set, in terms of which comes first, technically, we're due a Fallout before we are another Elder Scrolls.
No.
But that's if that is what they were to announce, that is probably what they would announce. Though, I do wonder, which, do you know what would be interesting to know is which... out of those two series on the last in the last console generation generated the most cash for them? You know, which made more money for them? Fallout 3 and New Vegas or Oblivion
and Skyrim?
And Skyrim. Because that'd be interesting.
Oblivion and Skyrim.
Say Oblivion and Skyrim.
But I'm not 100% sure. I know Fallout 3 was very big.
Very successful. There was a lot of... it was a bit hit and miss Fallout New Vegas.
Well, I am the least... I hate Fallout New Vegas. Anybody who says to me that they like Skyrim.
I want the next Skyrim. I'm not bothered about Fallout.
To be honest, I'm not bothered about any of them. I'm not really a big Bethesda fan, to be honest. Don't they mind?
Well, it's because you're not keen on the whole sandbox RPG style.
Not really, no. It's never really grabbed
Why
me.
Not? Why not?
It's...
I would have thought you'd have liked tearing away across the grass.
I know, in a way, I think it's too much back, freedom.
Ready to behead the vampire scum coming out of the caves. No?
I think, in a sense, to be honest, I think it's probably too much freedom. You know, you have so many options, even from the beginning, to how to build your character, you know, what to specialise in, what quests to actually do, and it just feels like it's too open. You know, I want a story rather than a kind of make-your-own-game type thing.
You see, story's really important to me in games. But Bethesda's titles are about the only place where I'll make an exception for that because I find so many other things to get on with. Though I think I've definitely gotten more out of Skyrim over the past few years than Fallout 3.
That and the fact that, in general, when a game tries to do everything as, you know, a lot of Bethesda titles do, and even GTA... has done in the past, where you've got like mini games all over the place, bowling, darts, you know, this, that, and the other, and they're never any good. They focus so little on those, you know, smaller games, and you know, it's completely throwaway. It's pointless. It's not that enjoyable. But
true,
yeah.
I think most of the elements of stuff like that in Bethesda titles don't really feel like mini games. Some of them feel slightly, but it's not in the same competitive light. So if you're doing lock picking in either game or
lock picking is another one of those gameplay mechanics that has kind of crossed over from like loads of different games to each other, and it's almost like a staple now. And it's kind of the way that it's done is kind of interesting. They've kind of perfected it, but by the same token, it's boring because you've played so many games before with that type of mechanic in.
Excuse me, whilst I get through my 20th lock pick, as I try to pick this master lock with only 45 points in.
You know what would be cool though?
Security. Go on.
What would be cool is if they do announce a new Skyrim and it's got local co-op play.
That's never going to happen.
I can dream.
It's so bad this generation for the lack of on same console co-op. It's like, just as gaming's becoming less stigmatised, we're going to stop you being able to play video games with someone else in the same room.
That's part of the problem,
really,
though.
The Wii U that's actually doing
it's part of the problem, though. You know, you've got this kind of tendency with developers to focus on this small core group, you know, and that's why you see such a different approach, you know, between, you know, people like Nintendo and, you know, going off the deep end with like, you know, mobile phone games and whatnot versus console games, where you have it completely focused, where you've pretty much played the game before you've even, you know, stuck it in the console. And you know pretty much what's going to happen. You know the mechanics already. You know that you're already going to be quite good at the game because the control scheme is exactly
how does this link back to the co-op issue?
Basically, because developers are focusing on that core audience, which, you know, they still see as people sitting alone, playing alone, but wanting to have, you know, that community type social aspect to it. So they implement stuff like online co-op and whatnot. They don't bother with same console multiplayer or anything because they don't see that as being part of their core audience.
True.
Oh, I love same console Left 4 Dead.
Yeah, that worked.
It was glorious. I've one last bit of Unless anyone want to give a okay, anyone want to give a final bet on what it's going to be?
Did they do Dishonored?
Yeah, they published it. I believe it was was it developed by Starbreeze or Arkane?
I wonder if it might be Dishonored 2.
To be honest, I think
maybe it might be all three.
Bethesda. The only way that they can actually have a proper conference is if they're gonna actually do a couple of different games, including smaller games that we haven't heard of, and maybe it'll be two big games. So
well, they might be publishing a lot of stuff. They might be shifting, you know, because obviously they develop their own stuff, but they also publish. So maybe that's what's going to happen. They're going to be talking more about what they're publishing rather than what they're developing.
That's a possibility, but I can't imagine them focusing on publishing that much when they've got two key franchises.
But they've been publishing a lot in the past couple of years rather than just developing.
I would like Dishonored 2, though. Dishonored was quite a cool
group. Dishonored was a very good game. And what was glorious was playing it through for the first time and getting the clean hands achievement first time round.
Achievement.
You got it the first time round, did you?
Yeah.
Right, I'm off now.
To be fair, though, I mean, you already knew about that achievement before you started, and you aimed for it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, you know, you just got to the end and you're like, ooh, surprise.
You say that, but then a lot of people who've aimed for it also fail to get it.
Yes.
Because
I aimed for it, and then I got caught by the guards pretty early on, and so I ended up killing them.
You see, I didn't, and I also was very good at making sure dead bodies didn't get eaten by rats. Or not dead bodies, but unconscious bodies. Yeah. Duh. So yeah, making sure that unconscious bodies don't get eaten by rats. Or drown.
Those rats have the munchies.
Really bad.
They do, yes, they do.
Okay, I'm going to move us on to our next story, which also happens to be a gaming one. Because the internet exploded last week with something that wasn't Gamergate. I don't know how that happened, but Peter Molyneux's kind of in the shitter at the moment on account of the
promising too much again.
Yeah, on account of the what appears to be a bit of mess in terms of the development of, I want to say goddess doesn't sound right because it's not spelt as a god, as goddess. Godess sounds more.
Can we get past the name?
I don't know. Can we? Because
I think your pronunciation means a lot more, though, doesn't it? Because he's trying to goad us into it.
If people could cast their minds back,
take over from Metroid. Bless him.
If people would cast their minds back to 2012 in the heady days of Kickstarter funding, that because everything seemed new and unique, 22 cans, Monolith's development company put forward a Kickstarter for Godess, which had the original funding goal of either 400,000 or £450,000. It actually made over £500,000, and they promised this, that, and various features for what was going to be their god game. So you know, you basically take control of a world and then steer it and do various things. And there was a lot of interesting
black and white look like.
There was a lot of
like a kid, wasn't it?
Really? Yeah, a lot of online features promised. And in fact, it was linked to his other, another game they previously released, Curiosity,
because which was on the iPhone
and Android.
Had the cube.
Was it on Android eventually or not?
Yeah, it was on Android.
Yeah,
because didn't the winner of that get promised the part in the game?
Yes, he got promised. So the winner of Curiosity, who chipped away at the right place of the Curiosity
the right
cube
time.
At the right time, won the opportunity to appear in Godess, in this online hub thing, that as like this like big character in that and all this sort of thing. And that actual part of the game has not really been developed at all. After 3 years,
they've left him out in the dark quite a bit, haven't they? Bless him.
Yeah, there's one guy who, I can't remember his name at the moment, unfortunately, who basically sort of like had been showing so much interest in the game in terms of like forums and stuff and all that. He managed eventually to get a job in with 22 cans, and he's currently, I think, trying to steer the game back onto the right path. But Monolith did a whole load of interviews in the past week or so, and it just kind of went a bit Pete Tong from that point, really. There was like, there wasn't any Rock Paper Shotgun kind of kicked things off by sort of like looking at how God hasn't delivered yet, and only beyond having, was it a mobile game, which wasn't obviously what was the main kind of thing that everyone wanted. Yeah. Everyone wanted PC, or I think was it they promised a Linux version, and they're nowhere near developing that. Like there's what is there a beta that hasn't been updated since sometime last year?
Yeah,
very early last year. That's on PC. Yeah. Yeah, it just all kind of went a bit wrong. There'll be links to all the interviews that he gave. But, how do I put this?
He just promises the earth, doesn't he? Yeah. Every time. I remember Fable 3 and Fable 2. He was promising this, that, and that. Don't get me wrong, brilliant games, but not what he promised at all.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of the chronology of how things kind of boiled over last week. So, like, Rock Paper Shot kind of did one article where they looked at, you, where the hell's GODIS? Then Eurogamer caught up with the guy who won Curiosity and interviewed him, and he talked about how, like, nobody talked to him and all this kind of stuff. I think there was a couple of other, like, roundups of what had been happening. Then Laura K. Buzz did, that's her name on Twitter, I think. But anyway, she... I can't remember. Okay. There'll be a link to it. She did an article for The Guardian, in which she interviewed Monolou over everything that had been kind of happening. And then on the same day, Rock Paper Shotgun released an interview with Monolou as well. Now, The Guardian interview was well received. It was considered reasonably balanced and all this kind of thing. And the Rock Paper Shotgun interview kind of came out, and it just... There was a lot of arguing over that interview, basically, on Twitter, and a lot of people wringing their hands and a lot of people calling for blood, because a lot of people felt that Monolou had been hounded somewhat in the interview by the Rock Paper Shotgun staffer, who actually it was the editor of the site, the main editor of the site, who'd interview Monolou. So the Guardian article and the second Rock Paper Shotgun article both came out on the Friday, so day, you know, so 13th of Feb, and yeah, basically Monolou's reputation is pretty shaky now. I don't know if anyone's ever really going to trust him again. He's now claiming he would never kickstart a project ever again, because the general theme from him is you persuade yourself to promise things that you can't deliver to make sure that you can get money anyway. And it was...
That's quite a bad argument.
You're like, basically, like, oh, you'll say anything to make sure you get the money. Then that's a bad way to obviously, you know, fund a game. Well, if you can't then deliver on that.
No, that shouldn't be the...
This was in 2012, this was all pledged.
I know, but... It should be a case of, look, you get to decide, the perks and whatnot. And, you know, you get to decide, you know, what goes into pretty much the equivalent of the advertising to it. So you're completely in control of what promises you make. If you feel like you have to make more promises than you can keep, then there's something wrong with the project.
Yeah.
That's basically blagging it, isn't it?
Yeah, and
blagging it.
In amongst all this, it transpires that most of the development team for GODIS has moved over to 22 Can's next game, which I think is called The Trial.
Really?
Yeah, but there's not many people, more of a skeleton crew working on GODIS now, including this one guy that's come forward from the community to try and steer things, because he was a backer, you know, and knows a bit about game dev, and it's all gone a bit wrong. It's all gone more than a bit wrong.
It sounds to me like stuff started going wrong, and then Peter Molyneux wanted nothing to do with it, and then wanted to do a different project instead.
That's unfortunately what it like sounds like. I mean, I can't remember the interviews, because I've read several interviews now with him in the past week, sort of in depth. But he's very apologetic and all that. But then he's still, the way he talks, he doesn't exactly offer many solutions to the people that stumped up over £500,000 for this game to be developed into something that at least retain most of the features. Because one of the things that a lot of people were excited for was this sort of online hub thing.
My question is, what happens to, you know, with when backers, you know, on Kickstarter decide to fund a project and stuff like this happens where, you know, features removed and they...
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the...
Can you get your money back?
The terms of service that the Kickstarter was already run under are different to the terms of service that Kickstarter has currently. I can't remember whose favour the terms have currently gone in.
Right.
In terms of, you know, if a project's not delivering, yeah, you know, what gets done about it.
Yeah.
But I would say that 22 Cans are currently... They haven't, I don't think, actually fallen foul of Kickstarter guidelines, okay, unfortunately.
Technically.
But they're walking a fine line, and it doesn't stop anyone from different countries and authorities from pursuing the matter.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be kind of cool as if, you know, say, for example, on Kickstarter, where, you know, you've got a project that's, you know, been funded and the people behind it kind of start to back out. I reckon what should happen if the community can't get their money back, the project and assets actually go to the community.
It'll be tendered to someone else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have they actually said when the release date's going to be then?
I think it's missed stuff. I think it was, you know, it was meant to have been stuff.
Have they given a new launch date or anything?
I don't think so. No, I think...
See that?
Because, I mean, they've got hardly anyone working on it. You know.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, if they've got £500,000 to develop it, then surely...
Well, yeah, but how much... Well, I wouldn't say much of that £500,000's actually left now after 3 years
totally
of development.
I would imagine probably not, but on the same token, they've still got to try and at least do something that's a, you know, final product for them, for the people who have been brave enough to back them, because that's just harsh.
I can't remember, unfortunately, if Retroid was a backer. I mean, he certainly had been posting messages about the whole thing. I got a general sense of unimpressedness.
He's probably hunting Molyneux down now, then. That's what he's up to. He's hunting him down.
Another thing that didn't help Molyneux last week is that he kept saying to various interviewees, I'm not going to do any more interviews. But then within the same week, he did like two or three. So that did not help. I'm going to move us on to what we have been up to. Cookie.
What kind of accent was that?
You don't want to know. There was no accent.
Yes, I have been addicted to a new TV show. It's not a new TV show. It's a new TV show for me because I'm so behind at the moment. But a lovely little crime thriller called Blacklist, starring James Spader. And boy, does it make you tingle. And every episode, I would be sat there going, where's the next one? Where's the next one? You fuckers, what's happened? Gotta watch the next one.
What's
really good.
What's the setup for it?
So, James Spader is one of the FBI's most wanted criminals. I think he's third on the top 10 list.
Okay.
And he basically walks into the FBI, puts his hands across his head, gets on his knees, and gives himself up. He then offers them his own list of criminals called the Blacklist. Criminals that are only known to him in the underworld, who've been able to keep out of the FBI's mention. And there's some really twisted figures in it as well. There's some very clever figures in it.
Sounds like a much meaner version of White Collar.
Yeah. And the other proviso is that he will only do it for immunity, and he has to work with a specified FBI agent who's a young female. This all follows their relationship, which is rocky to say the least. It follows both of their pasts and how they might have been mixed up, but you've still got no answers to it yet. And it just follows them sort of week after week, going after the bad guy of the week and how it ties into James Spader's character's actual past.
I'm sorry, it sounds like a meaner version of White Collar.
Well, White Collar, I have watched, but I have to say, James Spader just outdoes everything on White Collar because of his character. He's a lot more... He's not trying to be good.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole point of white collar is that it's allowed to be on, I think, at an earlier time of day.
Yeah, it is. But blackest, if you like white collar, you was blacklist. And you can see why James Spade can put up so many awards for it as well.
Is it on, like, I was going to say Twitter.
Is it on any on demand services?
It's on Twitter. I've got a funny feeling it was on Netflix.
Ooh.
Don't hold me to that.
Okay. Everyone's going to have to go have a peek. You know, watch some Blacklist before House of Cards comes out. After, oh yeah, oh god, who you heard about the tiny House of Cards leak that happened last week?
What?
No. They accidentally made the series live for a bit in like America or something, and to quickly scramble and take it down again. Somebody pressed a button a bit too soon.
Awesome. Because I have finished watching both seasons of House of Cards now as well.
Yes.
But on the same token, who's excited for the possibility of Netflix doing a live Zelda TV show?
Well, we did discuss this last week, and there were mixed opinions, and mostly because of the fact that the Wall Street Journal article or blog post that originally reported it said that sources described it as Game of Thrones for family audiences, and that just horrified us. Because
that would horrify me, that's right. I don't bother reading that, but let's just hope Netflix does do well with it. So if they do get it, because it would be interesting to see a live show of Zelda. It's got potential. Just as long as they don't try and compare it to Game of Thrones.
I'm still not convinced about Legend of Zelda live action series. Obviously I like the games and some of the fan stuff.
You will be there. You will watch it, Paul. You'll have to. Because if not, you'll be disowned by Nintendo.
What are you trying to imply there?
This deep, dark connection between you and Nintendo, apparently.
But
no, it will be worth a watch. Just like the Daredevil one as well. Seen the trailer for that now.
When is that out?
April, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Still got to catch up with Better Call Saul episodes now, but it's probably two by this point that they've uploaded to Netflix. But
which is cool.
I know Retroid seemed reasonably impressed by it last week. So, but meanwhile, I was looking into the other day, when's Gotham and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. back on in the UK? And it's like...
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't back on until in the US until this week.
Yeah, it was not back on. So here,
Channel 4 will probably be on in the next 6 months.
Something. it was something like March. Gotham...
Is back on the next couple of weeks, I know.
Yeah. I might be incorrect, actually, about Agent Shield's March. I think it's, yeah, Gotham's definitely March. But Agent Shield, basically.
Yeah, no, Agents of Shield, I really want to see what happens.
Yeah.
That's going to be awesome. Yeah,
it's always the same, though. When you have, like, a major cliffhanger at the end of, like, even, like, a half season, then the next episode you can guarantee it's something... that's not gonna actually be anything to do with that cliffhanger. Just to make it, you know,
if they make it a flashback episode, I'm not sure what I'll do.
They've announced some new cast members, haven't they?
Yeah, I keep avoiding any new cast member announcements just in case they spoil things a little too much.
You know, you were taking the mick out of my likeness, how much I liked Tomorrow People for the cast and stuff.
Oh God.
You're going to love who's coming in.
Oh, no.
That is evil.
Yeah.
No.
It should be interesting because you've got one of them in The Flash. You're now going to have one of the others in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Look. I'm just wondering where the rest of the cast will turn up.
And in related news, I think I did see Tomorrow People lurking around Netflix UK the other day. So if people want to see why I... just absolutely gawped at like the first few episodes, especially the pilot. That would be a good way to find out.
Am I right in thinking that the main actor in that is the love child between Tom Cruise and Taylor Lautner?
But in terms of looks?
Yeah.
Yeah, he does look a bit like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, he's in real life, though. This is freaky. The guy who played the main guy in Tomorrow People is actually, I think he's the cousin of Stephen Amell, who plays Arrow.
Hmm.
And it's him who's gone into the Flash.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. That threw me. I was like, thank you. This is becoming a family affair, this whole DC thing now.
Okay.
Some sort of incestuous kind of supernaturally type. Yes.
Paul, what have you been up to?
One last thing I will say.
Oh, yeah.
Save Constantine!
Oh, yeah, because... the
finale.
Yeah, so it's not... There's talks to try and get it over to Sci-Fi? And rebranding it as Hellblazer.
Hellblazer.
Which is obviously, kind of funny because you could tell they went for Constantine originally because that's what he's called in the New 52. And maybe they've realized that the more mature readers who preferred the Vertigo series perhaps jump on board more if they rebranded it into Hellblazer, as it was known under Vertigo.
It's coming out after Convergence is actually called Constantine Hellblazer.
Yeah.
It does make me wonder with that series, because I know Emily was very much dead set against it because you thought that they couldn't, really do it justice. So it sounds like they're trying to possibly... kind of go with the original.
It was just the fact that it was coming out around the same time as obviously the comic series and the New 52 continuing, and he was he's so castrated, or has been so castrated in the New 52 comics.
I was pleased with the series. You've heard me before on the podcast say that I was really enjoying Gotham, even in the early episodes where it wasn't there yet. Yeah. But Constantine, I have to say, grabbed me from the second episode. And I prefer it to Gotham.
Okay. Well, I might watch it sometime, but I'm probably going to pick up a physical copy rather than trying to take up an Amazon Prime subscription. Though they keep trying to give me free, 30-day trials. I'm like, no, I don't fancy
30-day trial.
Yeah, but the thing is that I've got plenty of other stuff to watch at the moment.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Definitely.
Anyway, Paul.
But yeah, we'll get to that.
Paul, what have you got to?
I've, inspired by...
You had started this last week, hadn't you?
No.
I was
inspired by Retroid's viewings of Community, so I decided, I haven't watched it in a while, and I'll rewatch it. So I've been rewatching Community.
And where are you up to so far?
I'm currently on season 3. Yes, that's right. I have managed to binge all the way through seasons 1 and 2, and partway through season 3.
And has Beetlejuice arisen?
Oh, Beetlejuice has come and gone.
Okay, that's for those of you who haven't watched Community, watch Community and keep an ear out for mentions of this fictional character's name.
Mm. But I mean, it's just such a brilliant series. It's quite light and airy. It's got so many layers to it, and it's just really difficult to do it justice on a podcast.
At the same time, I could give you some theoretical stuff to throw at it.
Who wants that?
Oh, come on. It's like a really brilliant example of using intertextuality in popular media.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, but lots of people don't know what that word is.
And you want to brag?
Yeah.
Explain.
Intertextuality is when something builds itself up by referring back to existing media texts, like really embeds it in. So, Community has obviously the Beetlejuice reference and tons of other things.
Tons of homages.
Homages and all that. Another great example of something that uses tons of intertextuality would be Lego City Undercover video game that came out for the Wii U. That basically has tons of references to martial art films. It is a very good game, and more people should play it. I mean, obviously, it's on the Wii U, but...
I am actually very, very close to saying sod it, Wii U.
Go for it. But on back onto Community.
Yeah, sorry.
But, I mean, the episodes themselves, they're, it's like usual kind of standard comedic fare. And the cast of characters is actually what kind of brings it all together, because they're so diverse and yet they come together in such a kind of pleasing way. And, you know, it's like one episode, it'll be, you know, the group threatening to break up over something, and then, you know, they'll be stuck together, and I really cannot do this justice.
Paintball.
Oh. That, I think that's the only problem with Community so far, is that it has regurgitated ideas, but that kind of comes back into the intertextuality with it being intertextual with itself. So, say for example, in season one we had a paintball game happening on campus, and in season two they had a two-parter of a paintball game happening. In I think either season one or season two, you know, the community college was covered in a blanket fort, massive blanket fort. I've just watched the double parter where Abed and Troy have a fight about whether to build another blanket fort or a pillow fort.
It's a very intense television.
Absolutely. So, you know, there are certain themes that kind of recur again and again and again in different, slightly different forms. But on the whole, it's just brilliant. I mean, even the minute detail, like, say, for example, the Beetlejuice reference. Or references, rather. And the script writing is incredibly snappy, and the acting is actually believable.
I haven't heard, you know, since last week, no news has suddenly popped out of Yahoo saying what the hell's happening, when, you know, when are people going to get season, or what would it be? Season, is it season 5 or season 6?
No, season 5's already out.
Yeah.
That's season 6,
so. Yeah, season 6 of the series. But, you know, here's hoping it might be sometime in under 12 months. Yeah, yeah.
That'd be nice.
Is it hashtag Annie's Move?
Yeah, Google hashtag. People still post to that. It's great. Like, I saw Paul was watching the episode yesterday, and I quickly went on Twitter and, you know, searched hashtag Annie's Move, and there's still people posting to it, and it's actually kind of cool. Like, it's got such that sort of, like, it's got such a pop, such a huge following that people are still active with it. It's really nice.
But it's one of those things where it's just so friendly for everybody, because there's something in it for everybody. And even though, you know, the one main character that kind of joins them all together, his name's Jeff, and he's an ex-lawyer, and he's a massive cynic, and, you know, some of his wit is absolutely brilliant, and he's, you know, very much not geeky. But the show is still a geeky show.
Yeah.
And I think it's brilliant how they've managed to actually do that.
Mm.
Yeah.
But anyway, Emily, what have you been up to?
Just working my way through that Supernatural box set I was given for Christmas, seasons 1 to 8. I had not, as I've said before, I hadn't previously watched beyond season 1 and had to rewatch it before I sort of properly started getting into it. I'm now on partway through season 3.
And how many times have people had sex on there?
I can't say. It's been a lot. There was... I think I should tell people what happened today, shouldn't I?
Yeah,
I think yeah. Okay, so I've been getting in earlier to work than I used to on account of driving. And I was like, oh, you know, take time, bit of extra lunch break. I thought creatively today, I could bring in Supernatural and try watching that on my work laptop. Yeah. I got through one episode and that was fine. Then the second episode, about 20 minutes in, Sam stopped having a sex scene with a demon. It was just like, and I had my male colleague sat to the left of me, and I don't think he saw much bumping before I quickly just stopped everything and closed the media player. But yeah,
that was the closest you've got to watching porn at work.
yeah, pretty much. So that was fun. But now, what was really interesting was, no wait, am I on season 3 or season 4? Excuse me a second. Sorry, I'm on season 4. What was interesting was that with season 3, because see, that's why it's confused. Season 3 is really short. And that's because it was the series that went out during the 2007 to 2008 writer's strike. And
that writer's strike affected so many series.
Yeah, I was talking about this on Twitter and Tumblr last week when I kind of realised this when I started watching it, because obviously I just blasted through that third season. But it is quite horrific, you know, sort of coming across series that were around at that period, obviously American, and seeing how there's almost like this kind of scar through them because of the effects of the writer's strike at the time. It's a bit creepy and weird. It's just like you just got all these series that were like would normally be 20 something episodes, and suddenly they're like 9, maybe 13 episodes long, so half the length of what they would have been normally.
So I think House season 4. There was Heroes season 2.
Yeah. Battlestar Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica season 4.
There's tons of popular US genre shows from that period that obviously were really heavily affected by the writer's strike. And some of them obviously didn't quite survive the effects of the writer's strike as well. I can't name any off the top of my head, but a lot of series just kind of...
Disappeared,
didn't they? Yeah, disappeared, or they just kind of lost steam.
Fringe was one of them as well.
Yeah, Fringe might have been affected, but there was a short season. Might have been.
Okay.
But, so it's just kind of weird, you know, sort of like almost like historically coming across this chopped down tree, and you're looking at the rings, and you can't look at the rings, and obviously, like, the rings of a tree can tell you how well it's grown over various years. And so you just come to this one ring where it's just hardly anything. It looks a bit meh, and it's just like this stunted growth because there was a drought that year.
Which is actually kind of interesting, because there's been, you know, a fair amount of recent TV series which has actually adopted a shorter episode set.
I mean, Agent Carter for one.
Yeah.
Really?
Only 8 episodes for the season.
Oh, blimey.
In reality, I suppose, in a way, because Agent Carter, I think in the US, is now on episode 6. It's got 2 more episodes.
Okay.
And it started about a week before, was it a week or 2 weeks before Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. finished for its midterm?
Okay.
You know, mid-season break. Then that's come on, and then that'll basically finish about a week after Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is back. So that might actually be quite a clever way of filling the gap, I suppose, in some respects.
I think one of the things that that writer's strike that happened, obviously, in 2007 to 2008, because obviously it forced a lot of production companies and the people working with them to create these TV series to suddenly go, oh God, do we just try and do a series as normal? Do we try to wrap things up and leave with a cliff? And are we going to make it through this? Do we need to tie everything up before this whole thing hits? That kind of thing. And it's just interesting. And
in
seeing it in action,
your analogy with the tree rings.
Yeah.
There should be a Dr. Horrible sing-along blog shaped hole in there. Because if nothing else, at least we can be thankful for that.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I perfectly understand why that happened when it
did. Definitely,
because
definitely.
It was big media trying to take advantage of creators as new media was beginning to be used more by them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as you said, it's kind of new media. And you know, the contracts and whatnot were obviously to do with old media broadcast kind of rights, and not even to do with DVD rights that much, was it?
Part
of the agreement was kind of an amendment for kind of digital and physical DVD kind of sales and whatnot. So it's just kind of amazing how much we kind of take for granted now. You know, the writer's strike was... What did you say? 2007
to 2008. Yeah,
2007 to 2008. That was 6 years ago.
I swear it's a distant memory in most people's minds
now. Absolutely.
Even though it has had lasting effects in the industry, and I just want to bring it back.
A lot of people.
Yeah, I just want to bring it back around to Supernatural now. I won't talk about sex too much. Don't worry.
I keep on teasing you that it's girl porn.
Yeah, you do, meanie. But.
There's been too much talk about sex all weekend because of the fucking film.
Who is my favourite Winchester brother? Currently it is Sammy Winchester. I do like their kind of like this family friend of theirs that becomes kind of like a father figure after season 1. called Bobby. Mm. He's quite cool. He's like a he's like a Giles, but only he talks with like kind of country American accent, and has a junkyard out back, and likes beer. You know, he looks like he's just a regular kind of Joe, but actually he knows buttloads about the paranormal stuff, and yep. and can read and speak in many different languages. He's actually really intelligent, which is quite cool. But there's some aspects to the series that do worry me a bit. Like, women kind of get a raw deal over the seasons that I've watched so far. There's a lot of womanizing going on, and a lot of sort of uses of damsel. Like, there's been perhaps too many episodes where the first victim that's portrayed on screen for whatever nasty's about that week has been a woman, and she's not had any chance to like defend herself, and she's completely helpless. And I mean, obviously I'm watching in such a close proximity to each other, obviously you notice this more rather than if you were just watching it one episode a week kind of thing. But it is perhaps at times like that, it is making me a bit uncomfortable. And I think certainly Dean's attitude towards women leaves a bit to be desired. Certainly he's a bit too much into the one night stands for my liking.
Oh no.
But I'm enjoying it.
Interesting, because out of all the people that I've known that are kind of geeky and you know, they like Supernatural, most of them have actually been women.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a whole air of treat them mean, keep them keen going on always throughout the series, which is quite worrying. Nothing is bad to say 50 Shades of Grey, but it's still, you know,
I still concerning. Want more women in main roles for geek stuff, because to be honest, Buffy, Fringe, Medium, it's not enough.
No, that's very true. But even the new Battlestar Galactica as well.
I will admit now that I have watched a couple of episodes of Agent Carter.
Ooh, okay.
And I have to say, they have got a woman, the woman hero, rather nicely. Quite sarcastic, very independent, very in your face, and kicks all the blokes' asses, the Timbuktu and back. And it's quite refreshing to see it on screen.
Excellent.
It is good, yeah, I have to say. That's something I'm thinking, yep, that's cool. good, you've kicked him in the face. Good. Nice one.
All right, I suppose we better move us on to the final bit of this week's episode. Not straying far, actually, from slightly comic book related conversation. Obviously, a few weeks back, or a few episodes back, Paul and I talked about how we'd gone to see Birdman, the film.
Yes.
And that particular film raised some very interesting points about the nature of comic book movies.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I'm assuming you haven't had a chance to watch Birdman, have you, Cookie?
Nope, I'm afraid not. I do want to, but I haven't got to the cinema to see it.
But it raised some good points about the sort of general kind of structure and sort of plot devices and characterization stuff that you tend to find in the big budget comic book movies that obviously keep doing well at the moment, that everyone seems to kind of like to go watch. I mean, I'll admit, I've liked to go and watch it, whatever. And nobody's kind of critiqued it in the sense of been like, well, actually, no, that is a bit naff, and, you know, that's a bit weak, and, you know, sort of. Yeah. Nobody's kind of held it up and gone, actually, maybe we could do better.
I think there's a reason for that, and that's because they don't really care about, you know, anything other than kind of making money. That's why there's so much merchandise based around it nowadays. And you know, that they're fine with reusing plot devices, and why Loki is probably one of the few Marvel villains that has actually lasted more than a film.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I think when I first heard that Disney had brought Marvel out and they were going to create a Marvel universe on the film, big screen, that I was very pessimistic against it. very, oh my God, what the hell are we doing, so to speak? We can't be doing this. But I think they've actually shown, especially with characters like Loki, how it can be done to a degree, right? But there's still a bit more work to be done on it to make it perfect.
I think too many of the films have relied too much on, there's like, there's not enough balance between drama and action. So the so much of the film is just shit exploding or things being punched.
I think that's where Warner Brothers could make a difference. Marvel have been successful because they've gone down the sort of one-liners, keep it action on the telly, and appeal to a wide range of demographic of ages. So you've got the sort of classic characters there that you grew up with, but with a more family-orientated mind.
Hmm. I think also...
Whereas Warner Brothers, if they do it properly, they could bring, just like they have in the comic book, a lot more darker. Teams to it, and a lot more drama to make it a bit more personal.
I think another factor with, not necessarily why they're so homogenous now, or so similar to each other, but I think one of the reasons why the sequelization is actually working extremely well for Marvel is basically because of the popularity that's kind of carried on throughout the films. And it's not just kind of referencing that previous one character's, previous films. They've got this almost like matrix now of, it's like different characters that kind of pop in here and there for, for cameos and whatnot. And I think they've kind of got to a degree where they can guarantee an audience for the next film. And so they've started kind of not bothering to take creative risks.
They've been a bit lazy.
At least with the storytelling.
I mean, the second Thor film, Thor the Dark World, and there are spoilers incoming. Spoilers incoming for Thor the Dark World. Spoilers. Don't want spoilers.
In other words, if you haven't watched it, turn off for 2 minutes.
Maybe five tops, but yeah. So basically, Thor the Dark World, that's obviously the second Thor film, Jane ends up infected with this primal cosmic force for all intents and purposes. I can't call it, something cosmic. What is it that Blimmin Silver Surfer uses? The something cosmic? Anyway.
Oh, the cosmic energy.
Yeah, but it's not that. It's just, it's just this weird, powerful source thing. And it's killing her, blah, blah, this, blah, blah, that. Oh dear, we've got to save her again. Yeah. And she took such a backseat in terms of having agency in that film in comparison to the first one. It was just really annoying to watch.
Mm.
And then it was like they didn't even then go with the most dramatic stakes they could have gone with. The stuff gets taken out of her rather than, because it's like hinted at that, basically it could, like, other than kill her, it might, just drive her a bit mad and she might just destroy everything. But meanwhile, rather than going with that choice, they instead get the power into the bad guy. That was kind of the obvious way things could go down. And then the film just kind of goes on its obvious path afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we're not saying that these are inherently bad films.
Makes for boring films, slightly.
I think that it's basically, we've kind of come to know exactly what we're kind of going to be watching, because we've seen it already before. I mean, I think I've seen, I think it's CinemaSins that said about Guardians of the Galaxy pretty much being the Avengers, but in space.
Yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy, while I kind of liked the film, it was predictable. I could see where everything was coming from a mile off, and that sometimes, like, knowing where something's going to go feels...
Yeah, you can tell it's a Marvel movie now, can't you?
But it's not just Marvel. I mean, it's a bit predictable. It borrows from other sort of classic films in terms of, like, arc and that. Like, it was a bit Star Wars, the plot, for instance. So you could really see where things were going, and it just feels so two-dimensional. I don't know if it's because often the comics they're based on over the years haven't been as... What's the word I want to use? They haven't been as, again, as dramatic and as they possibly could be, and sort of exploring how things could go. Because, because I've been reading current stuff with superheroes. So Squirrel Girl, the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, the comics are unpredictable in some ways, but then inevitably she ends up punching shit. And it's just like, so she's got a brain. She's trying to do computer science at college at this point. But, cool. And she's trying to make friends and that. And they do touch on this, and humor and stuff happens around it. But at the end of it, she still ends up having to kick the asses of stuff. And as I get that they're superheroes and that, but the balance of them kicking ass versus them talking their way out of situations, it's just so cliche that at this point that superheroes couldn't possibly navigate their way out of the situation without using some words. It's just really, really frustrating. At the same time, it's also why something like Gotham Central, which I've referred to before, the was it Greg Rucka and others that wrote sort of like several years ago, why that's so good, because it concentrates on the major crimes unit in Gotham PD, and they don't have superpowers. They have to talk their way out of stuff. They do shoot things, but they still have to do a hell of a lot more talking.
And I think that part of the problem is, in a way, they tried to drive the stakes so high, to encourage people to, kind of think of it as, quite an important, and, kind of go see it and whatnot and be spectacular. And I don't think that really works with being talked down, at least, in many circumstances. I mean, you would not be able to talk down, say, for example, Malachi, who in Thor 2 was, basically... the person that wanted to destroy everything.
But then that's like that. Then there's options where they've got sort of like the intelligent characters and that, and they don't go for the intelligent option for dealing with the situation. Like Bruce Banner, yes, he can turn into the Hulk, but he can do other things as well, And it's same with like Tony Stark and Iron Man. It's like, yes, he might be Iron Man, but he's Tony Stark, one of the greatest minds of our generation, according to the film.
I think also the other thing is that these battle scenes that you get are fairly, they're quite mindless in a way. You don't really tend to get the sense that, the characters working together tactically. And when you've got like seven characters versus an alien army that can, kind of do all sorts of things like, hovering, hover bikes and have these massive mechanical whales kind of going across New York City. And it's a bit unbelievable that seven of our heroes could do that without any kind of strategy.
We sort of got a bit more strategy at the end, didn't they, when Captain America took a bit more charge and told people where to go. That was about the only strategy you really saw.
Yeah, but even then, it's like Hulk smash. It's not like, hey, if we take out this guy first and then that guy, then you can get that weapon and blah, 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 that kind of thing.
They were giving their sectors to go and smash, basically, didn't they?
Absolutely.
I'd see where you go from. I think that could be where we've surprised a little bit with Age of Ultron, which is from the clips you've seen, it does seem to be like, as Emily said, the Bruce Banner has a bit more to do with the creation of Ultron, using his brain and the other limbs, along with Tony Stark working together. So that could be interesting.
But then my other concern is that the whole load of the trailer is destruction and mayhem, and I'm just like, it's just like, I get it's like it's just an entire film about fighting, and it's like, what, nobody forms any interpersonal relationships, nobody goes and makes breakfast, just because it's a film of the spectacular doesn't mean that you should completely be devoid of the mundane.
In a way, that's where TV actually has the edge on the films. Because you have, kind of characters that are kind of put together, and they have to grow together. You have to be able to see them kind of grow throughout the season in order to be worth its salt.
Yeah.
Whereas movies, they can basically just go, this is a period of time.
90 minutes of just...
Wham, bam.
Yeah. Bam Bam, thank you, ma'am. Disperse until the next movie.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much the Avengers.
I think that's why I am enjoying the TV shows a bit more.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, and that's how DC have done so well with Arrow and the Flash, because you've seen the characters sort of grow and become more.
We've seen it with seen it with Gotham a bit as well in like the later episodes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, I don't want to spoil anything, but in the later season of Arrow does disappear from the city, leaving the others to take his place. And that's been really interesting to watch, how they've actually come together without his leadership to do what he was doing. That's been quite a breath of fresh air.
I think that's one of the things about what happened with Smallville as well. It didn't feel like Clark was actually learning anything throughout the series.
Yeah.
You know, all the other characters, obviously, they developed in all sorts of different, ways. You know, at one point, the guy that played, the Green Arrow on Smallville, you know, kind of went through like a dark period and like come back and, you know, Lois Lane grew as a character and whatnot. And Clark Kent kind of didn't.
And
no.
Speaking about
that's what I didn't like about Smallville. He still missed the issues.
Is going back to Supernatural for a moment, the whole TV thing versus films.
Yeah.
Like even though Supernatural, again, there's lots of fighting in it. There's lots of guns in that, but there's lots of moments of like interpersonal relationships being developed and being analysed, and the characters sort of, you know, not just always been about, oh, we've got to fight this thing, and then we've got to fight this thing, and then we're going to have to fight this thing. And
I'm with a TV series as well, you obviously got, you know, an overall producer like, you know, Joss Whedon on Buffy. He, you know, at least oversaw the story arcs and whatnot, you know, even if he didn't write the individual episodes. Whereas films, they don't have that, you know. Really, it do is, they? Because Joss Whedon, you know, wasn't involved in anything other than, you know, the Avengers film. I know he's doing Avengers 2, but he's saying that he's not coming back for Avengers 3, and so somebody else is going to take over in a creative direction.
And also, you don't get really the same script writers either.
No, that's very true,
which makes a big difference.
Absolutely.
But it's just Birdman, in the course of itself as a film, because obviously I've kind of avoided reviews for it from geeky websites because the overall tone, the sort of first snippets of it that I've seen, it was just tended to be kind of negative towards it, because obviously the Birdman as a film is quite anti comic book movies as they stand at the moment.
In a way.
And just the kind of like how they're just this weird mix of spectacular cinema with little in the way of kind of
meaning.
Yeah. There's not much meaning to what's going on. Like, and it's just that is the problem. Like, there's been other comic movies in the past that weren't superhero ones that had a lot going for them, like Ghost World.
Yeah.
Or The Road to Perdition. Stuff like that. But then with the superhero ones, they just can't seem to get away from the more cliche moments of the comics themselves, which tend to be the fights, basically, and the grand battles. And it's just frustrating because they don't always have to be like that. The film that I've seen recently that is a comic book movie that gets this balance just right is Big Hero 6. There are fights in it, sure, but it had far more balance between character development and drama versus everyone kicking the shit out of something.
Yes.
And that's a film that's been aimed at kids.
It's also one that actually valued the intellect of its characters as well.
Yeah.
You know, where the characters were actually thinking their way out of problems rather than just, you know,
just go hit something.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say, oh, you know, Black Widow seems strategic, blah, blah, this, blah, blah, that, but she still ends up always kicking things.
Yeah. She uses speed and skill and, you know, obviously martial arts and stuff, but she's still an ass kicker.
Whereas the ladies in Big Hero 6 didn't have to always do that. They were given the opportunity to think their way out of things and not just hit stuff in some manner. And yeah, I just find it, I mean, the reason to talk about it is a combination of seeing Birdman and Big Hero 6 in the space of a month. And it was just the sort of revelation of, God, Big Hero 6 is just better paced and plotted than Guardians of the Galaxy was. Structurally, Big Hero 6 is better. I know that's going to be controversial. It's been better than most of the Marvel films that have come out, except for perhaps the origin films, as it were. You know, like the first Iron Man's really strong as an origin story, for instance. Yeah. But
I think so was Captain America, to be fair, because I quite enjoyed that, seeing him actually develop.
Yeah, and like, but like Iron Man 2 tends to get slated a lot because it just kind of went too far down the spectacular, as it were. And then 3, like, I like it because they finally let Tony develop as a character. So he's like,
his tech also evolves as well.
Yeah, but he's like, you know, he's all PTSD basically by this point.
Yeah, which is actually a nice touch. It was very humanizing, but by the same token, he was still kind of jumping into battle.
Yeah.
That kind of doesn't make sense.
Character development was hit and miss. But it's just basically what I'm saying is that I'm not wanting comic book movies to suddenly become Ulysses. Okay. Or similar. What I'm saying is that they need to actually properly balance some drama and characterization against the huge fight scenes that they do.
Yeah.
Because you spend so much of the film just kind of like, oh my, so tense and stuff as well, like, because there's a fight scene going on and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, when are we going to get to chill for a moment? Where's this moment where we can reflect on what's happened and everyone in audience and character gets a chance to think?
You know what the interesting thing is, though? Is that with comic book films, especially like the Marvel ones and to a certain extent the DC ones, how they're actually taking stories from, you know, their comic book history and kind of putting them together. Well, those stories that they're actually deciding to tell, obviously they're going to be, you know, some of the most iconic ones from, you know, comic book, you know, geek's perspective, which is good for the comic book geek in a way. But they have to kind of do certain things with the story and whatnot. And I'm not quite sure why they think that it would actually have a wider appeal outside of the geek community. You know, because obviously Civil War absolutely, you know, blew me away as a, you know, kind of comic book series. But as a film, I can't see how they can actually do it justice, really.
There were so many sides because it was an actual Civil War. Yeah. They haven't got enough characters to convey it as it was in the comics.
Exactly. So it's like Civil War. It's like, oh, well, by the sounds of things, it's going to be, you know, Iron Man versus Captain America and a couple of the Avengers maybe back in one side or the other.
I don't know how much of the Inhumans are they going to be bringing into it as well.
It could Spider-Man work with the Inhumans, well. But...
Mm. But, yeah, it's just... Basically, I'm saying that comic book movies, to me, they could do more. They could be less two-dimensional. But then the same could also be said for a lot of action flicks that are targeted at sort of like family to sort of slightly older audiences.
Yeah, it's like, part of the genre, really.
Yeah, it's like the Transformers films really needed help.
They do not exist. They do not belong. However, the first run had promise. It had some lovely little touches, but, and then
So long as nobody takes characterization tips from Twilight films, we'll be fine, because they failed on that front, as the novels failed before them. But yeah, has anyone got else to say on this matter?
No,
I feel like
No, I haven't been. I'm interested to see how they do Daredevil, because to me, Daredevil is a lot darker than all the other Marvel stuff they've done. So it's going to be interesting to see how they actually deal with that.
What I would probably say is it's kind of interesting how, you know, because obviously this is kind of the age of licenses in a way. You know, you've got stuff being not just licensed to actually produce into like film series or TV series. You're also having licenses, you know, kind of passed between one another with, as we've seen with Spider-Man and the Avengers. So it's kind of interesting how we've got this, and we're not kind of wondering. I think, as Emily has pointed out before, that the bottom will eventually fall out of it. So the end game for these, you know, Marvel films, where's it going to end? It's basically going to fizzle out.
I mean,
the end of Secret Wars and the Battle World.
Yeah,
I mean, westerns went on for a long time, but that's because they're a damn sight cheaper to make. So, you know, like, studios wouldn't notice that they weren't doing as well as the years piled on, because it's fine, it was still cheap cinema. Whereas these films, with their special effects and their ridiculous marketing budgets, they're not cheap.
No, they're not.
And all it takes is for Disney to somehow end up with, maybe a John Carter, but in its Marvel films. And it could send them questioning the whole sort of genre and sort of niche they've been eking out for themselves.
Couple that with the fact that they don't actually want to pit their own stuff against their own stuff. So you won't have, you know, like, say, for example, 4 or 5 Marvel films in a year coupled with, you know, a Star Wars film. So you won't have them competing. And, you know, they're going to kind of look at the figures and go, oh, well, you know, Marvel films, they're kind of on the decline now. They're taking less money than they did, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. But Star Wars is up. Stick more money on Star Wars. That's the only way that it can go. Obviously, not necessarily with just the case of Star Wars, but eventually it will start to, you know, do the rule of, you know, what is it, the law of diminishing returns. They will start to slowly kill stuff. And that's because they've just flooded the market with, you know, so many superheroes.
I mean, I remember when there used to be fewer superhero films in the days of, you know, between X-Men, X-Men 2, and, like, the first 2 Spider-Mans. And the release, and obviously you got, like, Daredevil thrown in at one point, and bit of this, bit of that, but the comic movies that were involving superheroes have been released so few and far between that I genuinely felt excited that X2 was coming out.
Yeah.
Now it's like, well, I could get excited, but there's like a bunch of them coming out.
Yeah, absolutely.
All with characters that I would like to see, so I can't just get invested in one.
And when you know that they're going at least up until like 2019, I mean, that, in my opinion, that was a bit of a mistake.
Revealing how far forward they're thinking.
Exactly. Because, you know, what happens if, I don't know, say for example, Civil War plummets, or, I don't know, maybe Ant-Man doesn't do anywhere near as well as they think that they will.
I still don't understand how they think they're going to make money from Ant-Man. He's just such a... I know a lot of people like him as a character, but he's just so... He's, like, so... I mean, okay, Guardians of the Galaxy did well, but I think part of that was because it was like Star Wars in terms of sort of, like, tropes it followed. But
yeah,
Ant-Man...
Guardians of the Galaxy was done really well, to be fair.
Yeah. But
Ant-Man...
Yeah.
Would have been, for me... Would have been more interesting if they used Hank Pym as the main character, because of the trials he went through in the comic books. He had so much depth. He went through being an anti-hero. Unfortunately, he went through that dark phase where he was ending up beating up his wife, alcoholism, mad inventor. There was so much you could do with that character that I was really excited when I first heard about it. And then when they said it was actually going to be based on Scott Lang, I was like, what? Sorry, who? What? Don't do him.
I think you've actually hit on
him.
I think you've actually hit on an interesting thing there, that comic books, they've had kind of, in a way, the time, not necessarily to mature, but they've had to kind of adapt their heroes to be kind of less than, you know, Silver Knight.
Perfect.
Yeah. Exactly, and I don't think that, you know, the films have really reflected it that much.
No, they haven't, to be fair, not that much. I mean, Tony Stark, you saw a little bit of it the second film when he was drinking a bit too much, but yeah. Nothing major.
But in the comics, obviously, at several points...
He really fell off the wagon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and you just never... Well, you hardly ever see that.
I mean, to me, Ant-Man has always been Hank Pym. I still can't understand that decision. I'm sorry, but no, don't understand that whatsoever.
Well, I think that's all we've really got time for this week. Genuinely, all we've got time for.
We have kind of ranted about that quite a bit.
So it is goodbye from.
It's goodbye from me, Paul, aka. One-armed_cookie on Twitter.
It's good night from me, Paul Blewett, and I'm on Twitter as @PaulBlewett.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter as @EK6891. You can find Nerdassemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. We're also available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can find us on Twitter at Nerds Podcast, plus we're on Facebook and Google+ as Nerdassemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out hexdimension.com, and also don't forget to fill out our survey at bit.ly/nerds2015.
We will keep on reminding you until you fill it out. You have been warned. Good night.
Night.